Wow, it's a great crowd. Thank you so much for coming out. I'm Anthony Brooks, senior political reporter at WBUR, and I just want to say how much WBUR loves this collaboration with the Boston Book Festival. You know, we talk a lot about the importance of great journalism, but linked to that is that we feel we're part of a great community, and this kind of collaboration is a great example of that. So I'm really grateful to the Boston Book Festival. Now, the election. We were talking upstairs, what on earth can we say about it? I mean, everybody, it's almost like we're all suffering from PTSD, and you know, I checked the news, Trump has a campaign appearance up in New Hampshire, and there he is in New Hampshire amidst new allegations of groping different women, so on it goes. And, you know, you can be forgiven for thinking that our political process has just gone into the gutter, and what's the point of even following this stuff? But I'm happy to say today is a welcome relief from that kind of stuff, because we've got four amazing authors and really thoughtful people who have a lot of interesting stuff to say about this process and where we are. And I know you all know that because that's why you're here. So thank you for coming out. And I'm going to introduce our wonderful panel. Ellen Fitzpatrick is a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. She's the author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. We've had her on Radio Boston, I think, twice in the last few months. Thank you, Ellen, for coming out.
Thank you.
And McKay Coppins is senior political writer at BuzzFeed News, covering politics and the Republican Party. His new book is called The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. McKay, great to meet you, and thank you for coming out. And Joy-Ann Reid, who I'm meeting for the first time, it's a great pleasure, national correspondent for MSNBC and the author of Fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide. Joy-Ann, great to have you. And last but certainly not least, Alexander Kesar. He is the Sterling Professor of History and Social Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He's the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, and the forthcoming book, Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Which is the very question I'm going to put to him when I talk to him. So thank you, Alan. It's great to have you. Alex, I'm sorry. He warned me how to pronounce his last name, and then I called him by the wrong first name. My apologies. Anyway, here we go. So the way I'm going to do it is just spend a little time one-on-one with these guys, and then we're going to have a general conversation, then open it up to you for questions. It'll all take an hour. It'll go by very, very fast, and it'll be fascinating. So thank you all for being here again. So, Ellen, I want to start with you. And you start your book with this scene from 2008 in Salem, New Hampshire, at a campaign event for Hillary Clinton during her first run for the presidency. She's making her speech. She gets interrupted by a heckler. You pick up the story. Then what happens?
Well, it was actually a sort of gag that had been organized by a Boston radio station, but nobody knew it at the time. And as she was speaking, some young men stood up in the back of the room holding up a sign and began chanting, "Iron my shirt, iron my shirt." Just want to add that in 2016, you can actually get a tote bag with a picture of Hillary Clinton that says, "Iron my shirt" on it if you're looking for one.
And how did she handle that situation?
She handled it very adroitly. Yeah. She said, she laughed, and she said, the vestiges of sexism alive and well.
Yeah.
And then she went on to utter this phrase that one of the reasons she was running for president was to break through this highest glass ceiling.
Right. Now, why did you want to start the book with that particular scene?
Well, the history of women's quest for the American presidency is a story about enduring resistance to the idea of a woman president. I think it's a little known fact that some 200 women over the course of American history have sought the presidency.
This is an amazing fact that I learned from your book. 200.
200.
Yeah.
And most of them were fringe candidates and third-party nominees. But nonetheless, the story of Clinton's campaign belongs to a much longer trajectory, and that is a trajectory that some of the gender issues that have surfaced in this campaign can be seen in that prehistory to the current race.
So the big question, many other countries around the world have elected female leaders. I mean, here's a partial list. Britain, Germany, Chile, Brazil, South Korea, Finland, Liberia, the list goes on. Mm-hmm. Many have female leaders now. Why has it taken so long for a woman to get this close to the presidency in the United States?
I think part of it has to do with the nature of the office, which combines not only the role of chief executive, but also with the role of commander-in-chief of the armed services. One of the interesting things about women in public life in the early 20th century is that many of them were associated with the cause of pacifism. Mm. That's not, as Maureen Dowd memorably said about Hillary Clinton's vote for the Iraq War, in which she accused her of having made a calculated decision because she had presidential aspirations, that she said Clinton knows that no woman will ever be president if she has love beads in her jewelry case. So long after it was no longer relevant, Senator Margaret Chase Smith, who ran, was very much a Cold Warrior. There was an association of women with pacifism and an enduring bias, I think, from sort of traditional ideas about men and women, that women were not suited to the duties of war making, of treaty making, strategy, and so forth.
Huge irony here, which I'm sure you've thought about, but here she is, first woman to be nominated by a major political party in the U.S., pretty close to winning the presidency, it would seem. But the irony is running against an opponent who in so many ways seems to stand so firmly against this kind of progress. What do you make of that?
Well, in some sense, I think that if she wasn't running, much of what we've been seeing lately wouldn't be happening. That there's a sort of chaos that is now emerging. If there were two men running, would we have really seen the paramours of the other candidate paraded out in the debate in the special box to potentially humiliate that man? Or it just seems that a lot of this is coming in the context of how close she has gotten. Whether you like her or not, I do think this is a dimension of what is going on.
All right, I want to move on to you, McKay. Again, the title of the book says so much about what it's about. The wilderness deep inside the Republican Party's combative, contentious, chaotic quest to take back the White House. And I want to start by asking you what explains Trump's collapse now. And by that, I want to just sort of paraphrase a great passage that came late in your book. You make the point at a certain point that for months, Trump survived explosive allegation after explosive allegation about his personal life. They'd flare up and fizzle out. Sins against conservative orthodoxy were ignored or forgiven. You write, even Fox News couldn't make a dent in Trump mania. After Megyn Kelly spent the first Republican debate hammering him with questions about a long history of misogynist statements, Trump retaliated by suggesting that her aggressive performance was the result of her menstruating. And yet he seemed to be unstoppable and vanquishing 16 opponents. How and why suddenly now has history caught up with him? I mean, maybe I speak too soon, but why now does he suddenly seem felled by his own being, I guess?
Yeah, well, those are two different questions. I think the answer to the first question is about how Trump came to be, even despite all of these outbursts, all of these sins against conservative ideology. I mean, that's basically what this whole book is about. There are a bunch of things that happened. One was that there was a kind of the largest cast of Republican presidential candidates in history was vying for the presidency, which made it very hard for any kind of unified effort against him to become strong enough to stop him. Another is that I think that for a long time, a large swath of the party has misunderstood the base of their party, thinking that conservative orthodoxy and conservative ideology were extremely important. And that's true for some voters, but for a lot of voters, as we've seen, they are not necessarily ideological conservatives in the traditional sense. Donald Trump, to the extent that he has a political ideology, I think it's come together this election, and it's kind of it's nationalism paired with a sort of authoritarianism that at the end of the day is contrary to small government conservatism. So I think a lot of things happen. I think that one reason that it's just now catching up with him is that a lot of, and you'll read about this in my book, is a lot of these other candidates treated Donald Trump like a joke at the beginning and were so consumed with trying to destroy each other that they kind of ignored him. I mean, consider, for example, this tape that came out a week ago, right? That was actually 11 years ago, Donald Trump making these incredibly disturbing comments about women. That tape was sitting somewhere in a vault in NBC for a decade. No Republican campaign, no Republican super PAC. These are very well-funded organizations with hordes of opposition researchers. No one found it. And, you know, it didn't come up in the Republican primaries. And that's because, and I've been talking to a lot of these people recently, and they said, look, the Trump phenomenon got away from us. Trump became so popular so quickly that by the time he was kind of steamrolling through the primaries, we had spent all of our time researching each other. Jeb Bush was obsessed with trying to knock out Marco Rubio. Ted Cruz was going at Scott Walker early on. I mean, these candidates were all trying to knock each other out of contention. By the time Trump was kind of on the brink of the nomination, a lot of these people that I talked to who work for these campaigns said, basically, we thought we were intimidated to the point where we thought he was unstoppable, and we didn't even bother looking into the sexual harassment allegations against him, the histories of mistresses, because we thought it just wouldn't matter.
It's really interesting. I remember early on in going up to New Hampshire before the primary up there, and in the early days, the reporters were chasing Jeb Bush around, sort of saying, what do you think of Trump? What do you think of Trump? He said this, he said that, and Jeb Bush just kept saying, I'm not going to talk about Trump. I'm not going to talk about Trump. He's not going to be president. Yep. He's not going to be the Republican nominee. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it. Of course, he ended up talking about it once he realized.
Maybe a little too late.
But a little bit too late. You write a lot about your own brushes with Trump, who made you a target of some of his famously nasty tweets. He called you a slime bag reporter. He called you true garbage. What did you do to earn that?
Well, first of all, a lot of those quotes we have put on the Amazon page for my book, so you can go check it out. No, also, the backstory there is that about 2.5 years ago in early 2014, Trump was in New Hampshire kind of making noise. He was doing the Politics and Eggs Summit, the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, a famous ritual for prospective presidential candidates. And I went up to write about him and had arranged to interview him on his plane, on his flight back to New York. And honestly, I'm not even kidding, my angle that I had pitched to my editors was, I want to go up and write about just kind of the sad, pathetic collapse of Trump's political fortunes, right? Because he seemed at the time, it was true. I mean, the Republican Party was sick of dealing with him. They had disavowed him. Nobody really wanted to pay attention to him. He was seen as kind of this sideshow. And so I had set up this interview. And I went, so after his event, we went to get on his plane, and right before we got on the plane, he got word that there was a blizzard in New York. And so at the last minute, as I'm getting on the plane with him, he orders his pilots to go down to Palm Beach instead, to his Mar-a-Lago resort. So I ended up spending 2 days with him down there, kind of stranded at his house. And I wrote a profile that he didn't take kindly to, as it turns out, and spent a couple weeks tweeting at me. Those are some of the highlights. And then he actually got you know, fake stories planted about me in conservative websites, claiming that I was like sexually harassing waitresses at his resort. He tried to get me barred from Republican events. I mean, he went, it really got under his skin, basically. Yeah. But I mean, the thing that I think that matters about all of this, aside from it just being a weird, funny, personal thing, is that a lot of people at that time, you know, 2014, were, that profile I wrote kind of channeled what a lot of people in the political and media class thought of Trump at the time, which is that he's unserious, that he's never actually going to run for office. He's been flirting with it for 25 years. And I think that wanting to prove all those people wrong is one of the things that's driven him, at least drove him early on to get into the race.
Yeah. You got up close to a lot of these guys who wanted to be the Republican nominee, and it included some pretty strong contenders with solid credentials and backgrounds. I mean, whether or not you agree with their politics or not, I mean, governors, senators, names like Jeb Bush, John Kasich, Scott Walker, Bobby Jindal, just to name a few. If someone from that group with those kinds of credentials had managed to survive the Trump show and win the nomination, how do you think they would have fared against Hillary Clinton? Or how do you think Hillary Clinton would have fared against them?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things you hear a lot from Republicans now is, you know, they're kind of tearing their hair out because they feel like Clinton, you know, while extraordinarily experienced and has a lot of things going for, also is a very polarizing figure in American politics and has been for a very long time, for probably a lot of reasons that your book gets into. A lot of Republicans feel like a more qualified, less insane candidate, not to mince words, would be doing better. I mean, look, but the reality is, and I think this is important to point out, is that I start the opening scene of my book is election night 2012, mm-hmm. when Mitt Romney, who, whatever you think of him, was not insane, was a serious person with serious credentials. Lost, you know, pretty decisively. And I think the reality is, and this is one of the driving questions inside the Republican Party, is even outside, put Trump aside, put the Trump phenomenon aside, it is incredibly difficult right now for a Republican to put together a national coalition mm-hmm. that wins a presidential race.
Yeah.
And this is because
of demographic changes.
It's because of demographic changes. It's because of the old coalition of the Republican Party espousing policies that are increasingly unpopular nationally. Yeah, sure. And so I don't know. I mean, I think that a lot of the Republican establishment has been able, and to be fair and give credit where it's due, a lot of the Republican establishment has, at least swaths of it, have disavowed Trump. But those people are, I think, kidding themselves if they think that is soon, you know, next time around we'll just nominate a more normal Republican and we'll win. They still have a lot of issues that they have to deal with internally in their party.
Well, that's a great question, the sort of future of the Republican Party and what it becomes after this election. It's one I want to talk to all four of you about. But let me come to you, Joy-Ann Reid, and talk a little bit to you about fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the racial divide. And you have a great sentence or two in your introduction that really poses what this book gets at. So I'm just going to read it and then just ask you about that. This book traces the Democratic Party's turbulent racial history and the rocky road Democratic candidates and elected presidents have trod on their way to reconciling their party and their country's racist past with its increasingly diverse future. So when it comes to this legacy of race in America, what's the challenge facing Democrats?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to this forum. And I guess the way I'll put it is that, you know, for most of this country's history, there's always been an ethnically revanchist faction in the base of American politics. It's just that for most of our history, that faction has lived inside the Democratic Party. And the thing that's different in the past than we have today is that it was an openly ethnically revanchist faction. There was open attacks on Reconstruction by people who were aligned with the party. Klan membership was an open, it was not even a controversial thing for the sheriff to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan. The people who committed lynchings were members of the community who were well known to everyone. There were governors of states and United States senators who could just be openly hostile to the idea of racial integration. And that lasted within the Democratic Party as a faction within the party, a known, quantifiable, open faction, right up until the 1960s. 1960s. And so what we had was a Democratic Party that was having negotiations internally between their more sort of open to the modernity part of the party and the racist part of the party. And kind of the thing that Lyndon Johnson was able to do, having come from the revanchist faction, was to turn on them and to really do it in 1957 and say, I'm not going to sign the Southern Manifesto. The future of this party is not in racist policy. And if you go back and watch old TV news clips from the 1950s, the N-word, not N-word, but the actual N-word with the ER, not the A at the end of it, was said on television openly. Nobody was embarrassed to use that kind of language, even on TV.
Yeah.
And so when Lyndon Johnson decides to spurn a pretty sizable part of his political party in order to achieve the Civil Rights Act of 1964, he does so knowing that that base, not just the 19 Southern senators, but that the voters who come with them were going to go away. Eventually, they were going to leave the Democratic Party. And so what you have from the 1970s to the 1980s is this cultural change in the language with which we discuss race. And so whereas you had an openly racist faction in the Democratic Party, after the sort of All in the Family age, and I sort of give All in the Family, the TV show, quite a bit of space in the book, because what you had with Archie Bunker, right, and this is a show that was actually debuted in 1969. Mm-hmm. It's seen as a 70s thing, but it was actually a 1960s thing that came after a lot of the rioting and the sort of racial conflagration. But the two main features of Archie Bunker's paranoia and his sort of panic are one about race and about African Americans in particular coming into sort of equality socially with white people.
Moving in next door to him.
Moving in next door. But the other was gender. Yeah. Was the idea of women taking a place alongside men on an equal footing. That's because you suddenly had legalized birth control. You had 1973 Roe v. Wade, which really is what kicks off the culture wars. It's gender that's sort of at the root of that. And so you have this change in language that Archie is uncomfortable with, the fact that you can't be openly racist anymore, that the idea of talking about race in that way becomes uncool. It becomes not proper in society. And so once this sort of eliminationist faction on race moves out of the Democratic Party and starts to seep into the GOP, they do it without being open. And so you have this prohibition on talking about racism within the Republican Party, the way you used to talk about it with the Democrats. So sort of the way that I work on it in the book is that look at how the Democratic Party had to deal with this faction, how they sort of expelled them, and then how they created this multi-ethnic coalition while Republicans inherit these voters, but we don't even talk about it. If you look at the statistics, the data on Trump voters, racial animus and racial paranoia and demographic panic is far more indicative of Trump support than economic want. There is no evidence that Trump supporters are poorer, that they are more economically anxious, that they are living on the brink of on the fringes of society. It's just not true. Hillary Clinton's voters are poorer than Donald Trump's voters, as far as white voters only.
So,
and
the
so
idea
you have this
that,
racial so, animus that just lives in the party.
So this is interesting, because I've sort of accepted as sort of part of the explanation of Trump. I mean, I get what you're saying, but I've sort of accepted that there is a sort of core of his followers that are just really pissed off about economic insecurity and international, those trade deals and so on and so forth. But you're saying that the numbers just don't back that up.
The numbers don't back it up. The poorest white voters are still within the Democratic Party. And what you have among Trump voters, they were actually slightly more affluent, for instance, than Ted Cruz voters. Yeah. And so these are not the poorest of white voters. They live in a lot of states that are highly rural, places like West Virginia, places like Kentucky, where I just came back from, where they are culturally opposed to the Democratic Party, not because they want, you know, lower taxes or they want to change things about, you know, sort of the economic structure in Washington, but because they don't like culturally what the Democratic Party represents, whether it's on religion, whether it's on gay rights, whether it's on race, or whether it's on gender. And so you have this sort of conflagration taking place on the Republican Party that we're not supposed to talk about. Now, some Trump voters are just Republicans, right? We're very factional and tribal, so that people who always vote Republican would vote Republican no matter which one of these 17 guys had become the nominee. But there is a core of what's happening in the Republican Party that the Democrats went through and dealt with, but dealt with on an open stage. So it's sort of fascinating to watch the Republicans struggle with this faction inside of their party without being able to openly address what's going on.
Really, really interesting. Well, I want to ask you, you know, when Barack Obama was elected, there was optimistic talk and sort of the elation that followed among many people about America entering sort of a post-racial moment in its history. You know, I think few people believe that now, but to what extent did he make progress in having a national conversation about race?
You know, when Barack Obama was running in the primary, I remember having conversations with my husband that, you know, whether Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama becomes a nominee, I assumed the Democrat was going to win just because of the factors that George W. Bush had put in play in terms of the country wanting change. And so I said, we're either going to get an incredible education in how sexist we still are, or we're going to get an incredible and painful education in how racist we still are, right? Yeah. Because so the country, it just... Because we don't talk about these things, you sort of need a symbol to sort of lance the boil. And the presidency is not as powerful as people think it is, but it is sort of where we do, it's our psychological couch. And the presidency is where we sort of decide what our anxieties are and who we are. So that, you know, Bill Clinton, so we worked out our Vietnam anxiety. With Barack Obama, we're sort of working out our racial anxiety. And he came to power because he did what black politicians who want to be national or statewide even politicians have to do, which is you have to put forward this racially ecumenical vision. You have to say, I am the magic wand. If you look at me, I absolve America and I absolve you of all racial conflict. I absolve you of racism by my presence. And while he was doing that, he was quite popular. And people said, it's hopeful, because the idea is that he would become president and then not talk about race. Right. That he would just show his black face, wave the queenly wave, and say, America's amazing. Yeah. But the instant he said anything that denoted him to be a black man and not just a president,
right,
he instantly lost the support of a sizable share of white voters. You can watch his approval ratings plummet the minute he mentioned that police officer who arrests Henry Louis Gates.
Right.
It's instantaneous.
Or when he talked about the Trayvon Martin shooting,
right,
for example.
So that even saying something self-evident, like if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon Martin. Barack Obama is black. Trayvon Martin was black. So if he had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin. But even a self-evident statement like that made him seem to be taking sides on the black team against the white team. Mm. And that is how much of white America read it. He became Kanye West. He became Al Sharpton. And his approval ratings dropped. And it's taken 8 years for them to recover. Mm.
But he had, he has this amazing ability to deliver sort of soaring rhetoric. And I think I expected him as president to address this issue in that way more than he did.
Yeah. I think that Barack Obama came into the White House not wanting to be the litigator on race.
Yeah.
He had a whole agenda of things he wanted to do, healthcare being number one, writing the economy. He wanted to just be a president. He was sort of pushed into the race conversation, both with the Jeremiah Wright situation and once he got to the White House. And it is sort of confounding to a lot of observers that he really had no interest in using his rhetorical gifts to litigate the issue of race. Because I think his advisors, and David Axelrod is this expert in getting black people elected statewide in Illinois, that conversation, no matter how eloquently he delivered it, was not going to be wanted. And he was right. People didn't want to have it. He was forced to have it. And I think having Barack Obama in the White House has been good for the country in that we've gotten it out, that we've now started to address it, but it isn't something he ever intended to use his rhetorical gifts to do. It just happened.
So what are your feelings about, let's assume that Hillary Clinton wins next month. How does she handle this challenge that continues? I mean, this need to have this conversation about race, this need to talk about this racial divide and the fracture that you lay out so eloquently. How's she going to do it?
I think the danger we have is that in the past, even with the George W. Bush ascension in 2000, we've always had an implicit bargain among Americans that you fundamentally accept the legitimacy of the president no matter how they get into office, right? So Kennedy comes in 1960, a lot of people believe he stole the election, he rigged Illinois, but they still accept, fundamentally, except for a small trenchant faction, his legitimacy. But we no longer have that bargain anymore. After 2000, I think it's gone away. So Hillary Clinton's problem is that right now, today, even a United States Senator, Jeff Sessions, is joining with Donald Trump in pre-questioning the legitimacy of the outcome of the election. So you're going to have a faction of Americans who don't believe she's president, just like they didn't accept that Barack Obama was president, like they didn't accept that Bill Clinton was president. So because there's going to be a large, angry faction of people who are being encouraged by the nominee himself. I mean, imagine Al Gore, rather than doing the let the glory out speech, saying, I should have been the president, and this election is illegitimate and rigged. We would have had people in the streets. Mm-hmm. And so I think the problem she's going to have is having any kind of conversation about gender or race is going to be so tainted by the refusal of a certain faction to accept her legitimacy as the president that it's going to be as contentious as with Barack Obama, but we're going to steer into a conversation that's going to be very uncomfortable on gender, just like we've had this very uncomfortable terrible conversation on race, but she's also going to have to pick up the race conversation too. So I don't envy her. I don't know why anyone would want this horrible job of being president of the United States.
All right. Alexander Kasar, let me move on to you. And this forthcoming book, why do we still have the Electoral College? And this is going to move very quickly into conversations about this election now. But let me just start with that question.
It actually links more closely than one might expect to what Joy was talking about. The notion that the Electoral College is not a good thing and the question about why do we have it and can we get rid of it is not new, it is not modern. 1,000 amendments to the Constitution to seriously modify or abolish the Electoral College have been introduced beginning in 1797. Right. This institution was obsolete by 1800, and everybody knew it. Okay, James Madison, the sort of leading craftsman of the Constitution, wrote in a letter in the 1820s. He said, "You know, really, we screwed up on the presidency thing. We were tired. It was hot, and there was." I'm not making this up. And there were signs of haste. and it's true. A little piece of this you'll appreciate. It. Like the Constitutional Convention couldn't agree on a method for choosing a president, and they got through the whole summer in Philadelphia, and it was very hot, and they still hadn't agreed. And at that point, most of them went on vacation, and they appointed a committee, which I guess has to exist in every institution. They appointed a group called the Committee on Unfinished Parts. And then they went on vacation and let the Committee on Unfinished Parts do it. And that's how we have the Electoral College. But so that's one piece of the background. And we should also know that a number of these efforts have come fairly close to success, or have because people have always been dissatisfied with it for a number of different reasons. And 7 times one branch of Congress has approved by the requisite 2/3 majority a constitutional amendment that would have dramatically changed or gotten rid of it. Yeah. So I'm circling back to the answer to your question, which is the title of the book. And here, one reason we still have the Electoral College is that it's very hard to amend the U.S. Constitution, right? It's just very, very hard. So there have been 17 amendments passed since the Bill of Rights in 200 years. So it's a difficult thing. You have to get super majorities of both branches of Congress and the states. But the other reason, and this, I've spent some years working on this book, and the extent to which this, I have to say, surprised me. I knew it was partly true. The other major substantive reason that we still have the Electoral College is the politics of race in the United States. And it's a complicated story there, but the headline version is that for most of our history, until the late 1960s, and even then there was some questioning, the white South did not want to have a national popular vote, because what the white South was able to do under slavery, and then again after the disenfranchisement of African Americans in the late 19th century, the white South, the way the Electoral College works, the whites in the South were able to cast black votes on their behalf. I mean, basically, they were empowered. White Southerners, because of the disenfranchisement of blacks, but because the Electoral College votes are apportioned by population, wielded much, much more power with the Electoral College system than they ever would have with a national popular vote. And thus, it was the getting a national popular vote through Congress was really a non-starter. And it's a tricky and complicated history, but that's really there. There's a flip side to it as well, which emerged, and this did take me by surprise, which was that starting in 1890, about the time that this disfranchisement of African Americans in the South was complete, the Republican Party adopted a position of being opposed to the other major kind of reform you could have for the Electoral College, which would be to choose electors in districts or proportionally, not winner-take-all, because winner-take-all is really the most deforming characteristic of the Electoral College. The Republican Party came out into opposition against district or proportional voting because they feared that since the South was solidly 100% Democratic anyway, if you had a proportional allocation of electoral votes in the North, that the Republican Party would never elect another president again.
I see.
So you had these two blocking forces. A final anecdote to put out there, which even though I can see a number of people in this room are of the age where they might remember this, but I think very few people do. We came extremely close to getting rid of the Electoral College in 1970. A constitutional amendment for a national popular vote got through the House by about an 80% vote. Polls of the states indicated that it would go through. Richard Nixon approved it, as had Lyndon Johnson before him. It was killed by a filibuster in the Senate led by, and if you have a long memory in American politics, these names will be very resonant, led by Strom Thurmond, Alan Eastland, the Alabama chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and Sam Ervin, who was actually not always quite as cuddly as he appeared in the Watergate hearings.
So one thing that I learned just recently, and I would wager that most people don't know this about the Electoral College, and that is constitutionally, the electors don't have to follow what the voters would have to say. In other words, I'm not talking about the situation in 2000 where Al Gore lost, well, actually he won the popular vote and then eventually he lost Florida, so George W. Bush got a number, the right number of the 270 Electoral College votes. The electors can actually then override that constitutionally, right? The Constitution gives them the power to do that.
I think that that's true. It has not really been tested.
Hmm. But is it true that the Constitution doesn't say anything about the popular vote?
The Constitution says nothing about the popular vote, and with no particular expectation that there would have to be a popular vote.
Yeah.
And a number of states in the first couple of decades chose their elector. The state legislature chose their electors. South Carolina did that. The state legislature did it with no popular election until just before the Civil War.
So isn't one of the purposes then, one of the sort of constitutional ideas behind the Electoral College, that it could serve as a kind of check on the popular vote in case the voters were to be bamboozled by a bad or dangerous candidate? I can't imagine that
Where
could
are we
happen.
Going with this,
One of the ideas behind having these intermediaries, there's this fear of demagogues at the time, and
right.
There was this notion not only that
strange.
People could not, it's very strange, that they could filter it, and there have been faithless electors who did not vote, and they've never been decisive in an election, and thus that was never really challenged.
Yeah, interesting. I want to just check on the time. Joanne, you've got a clock, because I want to make sure I leave time.
4:46.
Okay, we're going to go to questions soon, but let me just, I want to ask just a few questions of all of you, and feel free to jump in and disagree or agree, but I sort of want to move this forward to next Wednesday. One more presidential debate. Hard to believe that the nation is going to be subjected to another one of these. But I'm just really curious, and I'll just go around the table. I'll start with you, McKay. What's at stake in this election? And is there, in this next debate, and is there any realistic chance that this event could alter the overall contour of the race?
Well, as one of the many media commentators who very confidently predicted Donald Trump would never win the Republican primary, I will withhold that prediction here. I think it's very, very, very unlikely that Donald Trump can win the general election at this point. Voting is already taking place in a lot of places. The polls just are very, very bad for him. I think that what's at stake is not so much the outcome of this election anymore. It's kind of the the rapid decay of our, you know, American civic institutions that we've seen this election. I shouldn't laugh when I say that. It's serious. And I mean, look, that like the last debate was real. I mean, we have a tendency to over dramatize in the media these things. This last debate was I think, historically unprecedented, at least in modern political history.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And so I think that, you know, who knows what Donald Trump... I just came off the campaign trail with Donald Trump. I was in North Carolina with him last night where he dismantled his teleprompter in the middle of a speech as a grand gesture of his being unshackled. that's his word. It feels as a long time now, very close observer of Donald Trump, feels like he's becoming more and more unhinged, at least in terms, you know, if not mentally unhinged, at least unhinged in terms of what he feels like he needs to, what rules he feels like he needs to adhere to. So I think that this debate, you know, we could see more unprecedented nastiness and I think that that's just bad for American faith in our democratic institutions, yeah. And I think that that matters.
Joanne, what do you think? You're nodding your head.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we are seeing somebody who's been a public figure since the late 1980s in full meltdown, and we're watching this sort of nervous breakdown take place in full view of the public. I mean, McKay's written about it. Tony Schwartz, who's the person who really wrote The Art of the Deal, I've talked to him about this. He's done many interviews about it. Donald Trump's sort of core emotional center is the idea that he was this Queens rich guy, yes. This rich kid that Manhattan rich people look down on, that Palm Beach people still look down on, and that he needs this run for president to force people to respect him. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump was not going to win the presidency no matter what happened in the last debate. The reality is that the electorate becomes 2% more non-white every 4 years. It's close to 30% non-white now. That cancels out the size of the white working class vote. Even if he got 100% of them, he's going to lose 80% of the non-white vote. He's only getting 50% of working class white women. Normally, working class white women go Republican by 19 to 21 points. He's even with Hillary Clinton among that group. He cannot win the election if there's normal turnout, about 60% turnout. Mm. That is done. We're just watching this person, this man, sort of fall apart before our eyes. And I think going to Vegas, which is somewhere where he feels comfortable, where he will be on display, where he's going to put on a show, I think what Donald Trump is doing right now is he's aligned himself with certain media figures, Roger Ailes, Stephen Bannon of Breitbart, and this is now a play for his future market. The people that he's going to sell that black gold card to, that he said he'll give you a fake black card or a gold card if you become a Trump supporter, the people he's going to sell things to, this is who he is going to perform for on Wednesday night.
So meanwhile, Ellen, if that's the case and he goes on, he leaves behind him a sort of wreckage of a Republican Party. What becomes of that party? What becomes of that party? How does it reconstitute itself, and in what way do you...
That's a very, very good question. I don't know the answer to it. I think of us as historians. Our skills are that we predict the past. You know, so we're very good at doing that. Wouldn't you agree, Alex?
Are there stories from the past that might sort of guide?
I would say, in thinking about the emergence of Trump as a phenomenon, that I think that. In some ways, to me, he represents the logical conclusion of where presidential politics have been moving since 1960, when Kennedy became our first television president. And we saw the impact of mass media on a presidential race. It was a very different moment because Kennedy had many of the ups and few of the downs of mass media coverage. It was a different moment. People didn't report on what they knew about his private life. There were areas of the candidate's past that were removed from this kind of scrutiny. But this is all the more true now with the impact of digital technology, of social media, the anonymity, the trolling. All of this has created the moment that someone like Trump could walk into And I think one of the far more important than the question of what happens to the Republican Party is what happens to democracy in this kind of a setting where you can have someone who turns the election into a television show, who's extremely skilled at using television, who really, in some sense, you know, talk about live by the sword, die by the sword. Trump was, the whole phenomenon was nurtured by the incredible coverage that Trump got, enormous amount of time on CNN, free media coverage. It was good television. It was selling advertising revenue. There was an investment on the part of media in making it a race. We can't have a coronation. You know, Clinton looked like she was, you know, doing pretty well.
And McKay, these guys that you covered who were running against Trump, incredibly frustrated with how he managed to dominate that, what Ellen is describing, that medium, and just suck all of the oxygen out of everybody else's possibility of surviving.
It drove them crazy. And I mean, really illustrative example is Marco Rubio, this... You know, young senator from Florida, son of immigrants, Cuban American, Spanish. You know, he was seen as the great hope of the Republican Party when he entered the race. And in fact, according to emails we're now seeing from WikiLeaks, the Clinton campaign was afraid of him as well. Marco Rubio tried to stay on message for most of his campaign, which was, you know, giving these kind of soaring, optimistic speeches while also, you know, very harshly criticizing President Obama. But he was, you know, he's a very good speaker. He was good on television. But he just couldn't get the kind of attention that Donald Trump was by every single day coming up with some new outrageous stunt to pull that would dominate the headlines. And toward the very end of his campaign, Marco Rubio's campaign, when he was trying desperately to stay alive, he shifted gears and tried to play the Trump game. He started coming up with these really outlandish insults directed at Trump and, you know, making anatomical innuendos about Donald Trump.
But nobody could out-Trump Trump.
You just couldn't beat Trump at his own game. I think that a lot of the candidates that tried to afterward, I've talked to some of them, I've talked to the people around them, they're ashamed that they even tried. They wish that they hadn't done it. But you can see, you know, toward the end of their campaigns, they were so desperate, they just didn't know how to get some of that media oxygen away from Trump.
Yeah. Well, I want to take questions, but Alexander, I want to give the last word to you and take a shot at this. Either the question that Ellen raised, and that is, what is the state of our democracy when this election is over, or, you know, what the Republican Party does, either one or both. I'd be curious to hear what you have to say.
Very briefly on the Republican Party, I think that it is fractured and probably will remain fractured and it might reconstitute itself in name, but the fact is that the Republican Party has been a coalition of different branches that don't naturally adhere together for a very long time. In terms of the condition of our democracy, which I care about slightly more than I care about the fate of the Republican Party, I think that we are undergoing real stresses, and we're seeing it with the extent of the debates about voter suppression, which is maybe a fitting point, you know, to end my comments. The fact is that the notion of the legitimacy of elections is also tied to the notion of the legitimacy of voters. And what we are living in a country right now where 32 states have passed laws in the last 7 or 8 years that are designed to make it more difficult for people to vote, and those people are invariably of racial or ethnic minorities, young or old. And this is justified in the name of a fraud problem that does not exist. We know it does not exist.
And this is a narrative that Donald Trump works hard to feed, right?
Absolutely. And so what worries me is that enough people have bought into the mythology around this as to really pose, I think, a threat to our democratic institutions. 58% of the American population believes, or 50, I'm sorry, 58% of Republicans, not identical to the American population, 58% of Republicans believe that fraud is rampant in the United States, and that's an alarming misperception.
Mm. In the time that remains, and I'm not sure how much time does remain, but 5 to 10 minutes, we'd love to take some questions. So right here up front. Yeah, so there's a microphone up here, obviously. Just walk to the front.
So I'm curious of your opinion why I have never heard from anybody in the media the fact if Clinton were to lose the presidential election, we will have for the first time in history a president who will owe nothing to any special interests because he didn't take any donations.
Well, that's not true. He actually, Donald Trump did raise money and take millions and millions of dollars with donations. Now, the original story is that he put $45 million into his campaign, but they've been raising money furiously. I'm on the text list just to find out sort of what they're doing, and he sends out a text every day asking people to give a dollar or two, and then he'll send you this gold card or this black card. He's raising money in small donations as well as large. So, And as far as what Donald Trump would owe, I think what would be unprecedented if he were to become president is that you would have the first president of the United States who has a current lease with the federal government. The hotel that he's leasing in the old post office in Washington, D.C., that is a lease that he's taken out from the federal government. And we'd have, for the first time, a president who we have no idea what he's paid in taxes in the last 30 years, and we don't know specifically who he owes, but we're quite sure many of them are foreign banks to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. He could be in hock to the Russian banking system because American banks stopped lending Donald Trump money in the late 1990s because he didn't pay them back. He would take out these incredible loans and not pay them back. So Donald Trump's debts are unprecedented. It's an extraordinary shift from presidents who've primarily been in public service, they've been governors, mm-hmm. et cetera, to somebody who's been in private enterprise, failing private enterprise in many cases, and who's taken in hundreds of millions in tax breaks, but who owes hundreds of millions potentially to foreign banks. This is an extraordinary and unprecedented situation. I can't stress enough how dangerous it is to have a president potentially come into office with that much debt to foreign holders.
I would add, though, that it is true, and this is one of the interesting things that's made Trump's campaign so different, is that because he was unable to, and I'll talk about that, but he was unable to raise money from the Republican donor class, the millionaires and billionaires who typically fund presidential candidates on the right, he was able to break from core Republican orthodoxy in some key ways that other Republican candidates weren't. You know, some of the examples are foreign policy. He's much more isolationist in his foreign policy. He's against cuts to entitlement programs the way that most, you know, wealthy donors are. But one thing that I think, I wrote a story over the summer about this idea of Trump kind of being the outsider, always feeling like his face was pressed against the glass. He actually, early in his campaign, right before he launched his campaign, he thought, coming in because he was a billionaire, because he was this rich guy, he would have no trouble raising money from all of his other fellow rich guys. And he actually tried to hire Mitt Romney's chief fundraiser in 2012, named Spencer Zwick, who's kind of seen as this like big-time Republican fundraiser. And he would bring this guy, he would bring Zwick into his Trump Tower and try to dazzle him with beautiful women walking around. And you know, he'd point out himself on TV, and he would, you know, he's trying to do this whole thing. And Spencer Zwick, I'm told, just thought he was a joke. He thought the whole thing was hilarious and ridiculous. And that kind of is how the Republican donor class viewed Donald Trump. It added to the chip on Trump's shoulder, but you know, because he wasn't able to gather that money, he instead kind of turned it around and said, I'm not going to take money from the donor class. And that made him very, very popular in the Republican primaries.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for these sobering comments that takes us away from all that media nonsense we've been subjected to. But as Ellen said, you know, you the historians predict the past. I'd like to hear some comments on a few months ago I read and heard some very interesting comparisons to what was happening in the Weimar Republic that led to the rise of the Nationalist Party, blaming outsiders who were coming in, similar to what's happening with towards immigrants and Muslims that are going on. But I'd like you to talk about, is that analogy even relevant in a fear of the democracy? But on the other hand, I'm hopeful, and if that's not the case, and we do have a Madam President, and I hope we do, could you comment on what you might predict for the future if Germany, the United States, and England, all three, have women leaders. How would we be dealing with one Mr. Putin?
I'll take the first part of that about the Weimar. I mean, analogies to Nazi Germany are always risky and delicious. It is true. There was a dynamic of blaming outsiders, blaming immigrants. There was another dynamic also that was at play, which was that parts of the ruling class of Germany at the time said, don't worry about Hitler. He's a clown. Even if he comes to power for a year or two, he has no serious skills. He's not going to be a threat. Let him make a lot of noise, and we'll run him. And we know how that turned out. The other interesting parallels, and something we ought not disregard in our American focus, which is appropriate, is that there are political movements and political impulses quite like Trumpism showing up in various places in the world right now, right? I mean, it exists in England. It exists very strongly in France and other places in Europe, Eastern Europe. So there's a broader set of issues that's feeding into this beyond the peculiarities of being American.
And for the same reason, because right. You have in Europe the reaction to the influx of refugees from the Middle East, and so the sort of Arabization of Europe and the demographic panic. So it's the same thing for the same reason. And interestingly enough, you mentioned Vladimir Putin. Putin and the FSB have been stoking these right-wing movements all around the world, ginning them up, finding ways to support them, as they are also doing with Donald Trump.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, that sort of feeds into my question about after the election, where I am terrified. Either way, because I feel like so much hate has been stirred up, and there's this conspiracy theory stuff being stirred up about the election being rigged, and the people who are going to be most unhappy, I think, are the people with guns. So this all makes me just really fearful in a way that I've never been about, like, armed insurrection or something worse. But I also feel like the country is split apart in a strange way between, say, if the presidency keeps being Democratic and all the state governments keep being Republican because of weirdness with gerrymandering and stuff. So I guess I don't really have a coherent way of formulating this question, but what do you feel like after the election can possibly happen to bring people together and to get back to some kind of more civilized way of managing our society and our differences?
Small question. Who wants to take that? Joy-Ann.
Well, you know, since
fix all our problems.
Right, exactly. Well, since my name is Joy, I'll give the most ironic answer. It might depress you a little bit, but the Southern Poverty Law Center has found the two greatest spikes in armed militia activity and domestic terrorism were the election of Bill Clinton and the election of Barack Obama. Both had record levels of militia activity, and I think we're going to see the same thing happen again. I think with the election of Hillary Clinton, you're going to see a spike in that kind of violence, and it's actually kind of scary.
Yeah.
Because I think in a lot of ways, we are and were two countries that are sort of forced together, and the Civil War sort of sealed our fate, and we're arm in arm into the abyss in a lot of ways. We're structurally made to be a federalist republic, so that the states are constantly tugging for power against the federal government. I don't think that's going to change. And I think that the fear that you talked about of this rising non-white demographic that's only just going to keep getting bigger. You know, the 2020 election is what I call the Armageddon election, because you're going to have a population that's going to be about 32% non-white, which means that the Republican could win 65, 66% of the white vote and still lose. And then you'll also have a census year tied to that, when the party that wins the White House could then lock in power across the country, statewide, Congress, and the White House, lock that up and lock the non-White House part of it up for 10 years. So I think we are in for, we're not in for better times in the immediate future, unfortunately.
And somehow minorities didn't get Trump's word that Hispanics and African-Americans loved him.
His African-American. Yeah.
I must say I feel a little bit more hopeful in the sense that I think that what we've seen in recent years are breaches in the wall. And if you think about your very eloquent narrative of the changes that occurred in the Democratic Party, one of the key things that happened was that the rules of the Democratic Party changed because civil rights activists, women, radicals made it so. Mm-hmm. And so out of that emerged Shirley Chisholm in 1972, and eventually our first African-American president, and perhaps we'll have a woman president this time. When those breaches in the wall occurs, the water rushes in, the ocean is roiled, and it takes a while for, it seems, it's taking a while. It actually, it seems to me we've seen a spike in outright racism and a feeling on people's part that it's perfectly okay to express these views. And we're seeing it in the gender realm as well. But it may not necessarily mean that all is lost. To me, it may be part of this unsettled lurch forward, as unattractive as it may be.
Last question. We have got time for one more, so go ahead. Yes, please.
That's a good one. Back to the question about the donor class. You know, in a normal election year, you expect to hear a great deal about the impact that dark money, that Citizens United, and so on and so forth would have had upon the election. We're not hearing that now. We're hearing more like, we're the enemy of democracy. But I suspect that the donor class is not dead. Can you speak to its effect in this election year and possibly in the future?
Well, I can say, you know, as somebody who covers the Republican Party, I spend a lot of time talking to Republican donors. There's a Democratic donor class as well, of course. You know, it's interesting because Donald Trump, the phenomenon, has not needed that much money to take off, right? Because partly we talked about earlier, he benefited from so much free media coverage. He didn't need to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on television ads, which is usually the greatest expense for presidential campaigns. I will say that, you know, it's interesting. Mitt Romney has a summit of kind of elite donors and other Republican elites and other political elites as well in Park City every year. This past summer, and he lets them speak to his crowds. And this one of his speakers was a very successful businessman. It's a closed-door summit, but this later leaked out, this speech. And he basically stood up and gave a very blunt speech saying, look, the Republican Party for decades has existed because people like us, the business class, the corporate class, made a deal with social conservatives, which was, we will support your issues if you support ours, right? And that coalition now is fraying. It's not working anymore. And basically what a lot of people in the elite Republican donor class are saying is that we need to make a new deal, basically. Donald Trump has revealed some of the issues that the base care about that are anathema to the Republican donor class, issues like trade, free trade, issues like immigration. And basically, I think what we're going to see in the coming years after this election is Republican donors figuring out what concessions they're willing to make to the Trumpist wing of the party hopefully for them, create some kind of new national coalition. But that's going to be a source of tension in the donor class for years to come.
All right. I want to thank all four of you, McKay Coppins, Joy-Ann Reed, Alexander Kaysar, and Ellen Fitzpatrick. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is fun.
That's good.